Okay, if you are a visitor here, you're really welcome. We're making our way through John's Gospel, one of the four accounts of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection that we have in the New Testament. And today we're looking at the passage that was read to us by Paul. And it's really about the fallout of Jesus raising his friend Lazarus from the dead. Okay, as we start, I want you to consider two hypothetical scenarios. Okay, and I want you to think about why each of them, both of them, happens. Okay, the first involves a friend of yours. And this person is someone who you have always looked up to as a person of integrity. But you hear on the grapevine that they have done something that you could never have imagined them doing. Okay, it might be financial, it might be relational, it might be sexual, it might be academic, some kind of academic fraud. And whether or not it is illegal, it is certainly immoral. And it seems to cut against everything that you thought this person stood for. And you are left reeling. Okay, that's the first scenario. Second scenario. You witness someone, maybe a colleague, maybe a friend, might even be yourself, and you see this person react to something that is said or done, which to you seems pretty minor, but their reaction is out of all proportion to what has happened. It's almost violent in its emotion. And in both of those situations, you are left watching and thinking, why? What has happened? Why would someone behave in ways that seem to go directly against what they say they believe? Scenario one. And scenario two, why would somebody react so violently, emotionally violently, to something that to you seems more trivial? And of course, one reason why, when we witness things like that going on, that we should ask the question, why, is you don't want to be either of those people, do you? I mean, you want to be a person of integrity, don't you? You want to live consistent with your beliefs, scenario one, and you do not want to be a living, breathing volcano. You don't want to constantly be getting angry or cutting people down with your words from seemingly trivial things. Okay, so look at verses 45 and 46 of our reading. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary, that's Lazarus' sister, and had seen what he, Jesus, did, believed in him. But some... Okay, so among the crowd of people who have witnessed Jesus calling Lazarus out of the tomb, many of those people, John tells us, believed in him, put their trust in Jesus. But interestingly, not everyone. And as we will see, they go off and tell other people, and other people who hear about this also don't trust Jesus. In fact, for some of them, their reaction and subsequent behaviour runs straight against what they say they believe, scenario one. And for others, their reaction is violent, scenario two. Same Jesus, same event, very different reactions. And this passage helps us explain why. Okay, so we're going to look at three things. Firstly, what you most value. Secondly, the consequences of getting that wrong. The consequences of getting what you most value wrong. And thirdly, what you should most value and why. What should be of supreme value. Okay, first point then, what you most value. Okay, look again at verses 45 and 46. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, Jesus did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees. Okay, so again, as we saw last week, the crowd around the tomb hear Jesus commanding death to loose its grip on Lazarus. And they hear Jesus commanding Lazarus to come out of the tomb. And Lazarus does just that. And John tells us many people who saw that happening believed. They realized something of who Jesus really is, and they trust him. But others go off to the Pharisees. In verse 46, they tell them what Jesus had done. I don't know if you saw her obituary in the news last week, but André Dumont, who was Belgian, died at the end of January at the age of 102. And as I say, she was Belgian. And in 1941, when she was just 17, she joined the resistance against the Nazi occupation. And through her work with the resistance, she saved dozens of Allied airmen who had been shot down, because it was her job to accompany them, just 18-year-old girl, it was her job to accompany them using false papers for herself and for the airmen, to accompany them on the underground escape route to Paris, getting them through the checkpoints, they didn't speak any French, okay, getting them, because they were English or American, getting through the checkpoints, getting through the Gestapo checks, until she could hand them over to another courier in Paris for their onward journey to Spain. But in 1942, André Dumont was betrayed by an informant. And along with her father, she was arrested and sent to the concentration camps in Germany, where her dad died, but she somehow survived. Ask yourself, why would someone betray her? Why would someone betray her and her colleagues? I mean, maybe it was a neighbour. I mean, I don't think she ever knew. Maybe it was someone who feared that the work of the resistance might get others, the betrayer, my family, might get us into trouble. Maybe it was out of loyalty or sympathy for the Nazi cause. I don't think she ever knew. Okay, we can ask the same questions here, can't we? Why witness this incredible event, a beloved brother being raised back to life and given back to his family, but rather than hang around and enjoy and take part in the joy of the family at that event, why would you pick up your stuff, head for the exit, and go and find the guys who have set themselves as enemies against Jesus? Why would you do that? Well, maybe, as some have suggested, maybe they want to try and change the Pharisees' minds. They've seen something amazing, and they go down to the Pharisees and they go, guys, Jesus is a good guy. You've got to change your opinion. You've got to drop your opposition. He's one of us. Except what's interesting is that John is clearly contrasting the two responses, isn't he? Many believe, but some. Many believe, but others, and the implication is, don't. Why? Well, back in chapter 9, we saw these same Pharisees excommunicate a man from the synagogue, a man who had been born blind, but who Jesus had healed. And why did they excommunicate him? Why did they kick him out? Because he refused to side with them against Jesus. He sided with Jesus. So maybe these people who run off down to the Pharisees, maybe they're fearing that is going to happen to them. Maybe they are fearing the social pressure. Maybe they realize that just like the blind man, they have been caught up in another one of Jesus's miracles, and they don't want what happened to him to happen to them. Or maybe their loyalty really does lie with the Pharisees. Okay, as you watch them and question why they would do it, I want you to think about your own responses, our own hearts. Okay, maybe you're here this morning, you're not yet a Christian, but you've been coming to church, or you've been reading the Bible, and you have begun to see something of Jesus' power. Or maybe like someone I was talking with last week, maybe you've seen the impact of Christ on your friend's life, but you're still holding out on Jesus. Okay, you're keeping him at arm's length. You're not running off to the Pharisees, but neither are you committing yourself to him. And could one reason for that be that you are all, you know, if they're here concerned about what the Pharisees might think of them, could the reason for you be that you are also concerned about what people might think of you? If you did this, if you did become a Christian, you too feel the social pressure that in some ways this might cost you. Or maybe you are a Christian, but at work or with friends, you too feel this social pressure. Okay, to not side with Jesus publicly. And sometimes you find yourself saying things or doing things or not saying things and not doing things that you should do. Okay, why can social pressure affect us like that? Well, it's about what matters most to you, doesn't it? Isn't it? And whether just in the moment or longer term in your life, the approval, the admiration, the respect of others, or the desire for self-preservation, or just the desire not to feel awkward, that desire to be comfortable, in that moment, that seems more valuable to you than Christ. And so we deny the thing that we say that we value above all, because in reality, something else has that place. Okay, now I want you to look at the Pharisees. Think about the Pharisees themselves. Look at verse 47. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, "What are we to do?" Okay, does anything about that strike you as odd? Okay, the Pharisees hear what Jesus has done, and their response is to team up with the chief priests and call the council, the Sanhedrin, together. Anything about that strike you as odd? Okay, it's this. The Pharisees were the cultural and theological conservatives of the day. But the Sadducees, the chief priests, were the liberals, the progressives of the day. Okay, and so not for the last time, the conservatives and the progressives come together and their common enemy is Christ. And might that be that whatever they say, their theological beliefs or their opinions on culture are not in fact the thing that matters most to them, but something else has that place. Okay, but look at their question. Okay, what are we to do? Guys, we've got a problem and we need to redouble our efforts to fix it. We've got to manage this. We've got to manage this man, Jesus. Okay, you can't manage Christ, can you? You can't try and contain him. He is unmanageable. He's untamable. You know, Charles Spurgeon, the great British Victorian preacher, he used to criticise people who wanted to try and defend the Bible. "Defend the Bible," he said. "I would soon as defend a lion. Unchain it. Let it out of its cage. Let it roar. It will defend itself." If that's true of the Bible, it's true of Christ, isn't it? In The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, one of C.S. Lewis's novels, the Pevensey children ask Mr. and Mrs. Beaver whether Aslan the lion, who's a picture of Christ, is safe. "Safe?" said Mr. Beaver. "Who said anything about safe? Course he isn't safe. But he's good. He's the king, I tell you." And Mr. Tumnus, the fawn, says, "He's wild." Okay, are you trying to manage Christ? Are you trying to keep him contained? Okay, maybe you think that you can have one foot in both camps, one foot in the church, but one foot in the world. Maybe you're thinking you can manage him. Maybe you want to restrict his access in your life to certain compartments of your life, because who wants a roaring lion prowling around their house? Okay, but ask yourself, why do these people want to try and restrict him? Why do they want to try and cage him? Why do they want to manage him? Well, look at verses 47 and 48. For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Okay, so if some in the crowd, consciously or subconsciously, feel threatened by the Pharisees and the Sadducees also feel threatened. They feel threatened by Jesus and by the Romans, because if Jesus gains a following and these followers start talking about Jesus as the king, as the Messiah, then this could end up in a full-blown revolt against Rome. And if that happens, there is only going to be one victor. And our place, the temple, and our nation will be lost. Okay, so they see Jesus as a threat to civil order and religious freedom and national identity, all of which are valid concerns. But are they? At least, are they for them? Is that really what is bothering these leaders? Okay, notice how they phrase their concern. The Romans will come and take away our place and our nation. And in Greek, the our is in the emphatic position. Normally it comes after the noun. Here it comes first. Our place, our nation. We need to act because we stand to lose if we don't. Our place, our nation, our position, our prestige, our identity as leaders is at risk here. And it is that they most value. It is that they most love. And it is being threatened by Jesus. And they may cloak it in concern for the public good. But in reality, they are concerned for themselves. Okay, so think again about that scenario of some second scenario of someone reacting out of all proportion to what has been said or done. And ask yourself, what's being threatened? What is it that they most love, that they most value, that is being threatened, that causes them to react like this? Is it their pride? Is it their reputation? Is it their control? Is it their identity? Because there's always going to be something that we value above everything. There's going to be something that we worship. There's going to be something that we look to for our security, for our worth, for our sense that we are good, that we've made it. And when that is threatened, it is like our very self is being threatened. And boy, do we notice it. It's why David Foster Wallace, the American writer who is not a Christian, said, "In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. Everybody has something of supreme value. We've been made like that." So if you find yourself holding out on Jesus in your life, you're not yet a Christian, or in some area of your life, just ask yourself, what is he threatening? What do I think he's threatening? Is it your freedom? That you need to, your freedom to do as you want, and you don't want to give that up? But listen, if you worship freedom, freedom will become your slave master. I mean, just look at our current society. And you will never have any meaningful relationships, because true love always nails you down. True love always curtails your freedom. Is it being in control? And you don't want to cede control of your life to Christ. But listen, if you value control over everything else, then it's not just that you are going to see Jesus as a threat, you're going to see everybody else as a threat. And like a child who thinks there's a monster hiding behind every tree, you will interpret the actions of colleagues or co-workers as attempts to take you down. Value control, and you are going to live your life on a paranoid knife edge. You see, it's what you most value that determines what you fear. But it is what you most fear and what you most value that will determine how you live. Second point then, the consequences of getting it wrong, the consequences of getting what you most value wrong. Now, as you watch these leaders react to and discuss the news of Jesus, of Lazarus being raised, what's missing? Okay, look what they say, verse 47. This man performs many signs. So they're not disputing that, are they? They're not denying the facts of what has happened. But what do they do with those facts? Do they allow them to challenge their negative views about Jesus or to reframe their thinking about life and death? And interestingly, the answer is no. Okay, their love of position and prestige and power has blunted their critical faculties. It has clouded their reason. So they don't want or they can't or they won't re-examine the evidence or reconsider their worldview. Okay, but again, I want you to think how that can happen today, and not just because of a love of position or prestige. Okay, maybe the thing that matters most to you is your leisure time. Maybe you love the next adventure, you love travel, you love having a great time. So when we do have time, okay, time to think, actually we tend not to think. Leisure or entertainment is what occupies our thinking. And the superficial squeezes out the deeper stuff. And the danger is that we exist in the shallows. And we never quite get round to thinking about the deep and the big issues of life and death or who Jesus really is. Or if your career and furthering it is what matters most to you, then in all likelihood, you won't have much time or patience for thinking deeply about the claims of Christ on your life. You might hear about Jesus, you might even acknowledge what you hear is true, but you never quite follow through on it because there's always something that's more important. There's another project to get yourself into. There's another paper to write because something else has your heart. All of us see life and live life through the lens of what we most value. Okay, but again, think about the Pharisees in particular. You see, one of the things that set them apart from the Sadducees in the first place was that the Pharisees believed in the resurrection. Okay, they believed that the day would come when God would raise the dead and he would establish his kingdom. And here they get news that a dead man has been raised and that the resurrection at the end of time has broken into time and the kingdom of God is being proclaimed and that the thing that they believed in, the very thing that they have longed for is coming to pass. Do they rejoice in that? They don't, do they? Why not? Because if you value power or prestige or wealth or freedom or control or any number of things more than God, you will not live true to what you believe. Or you will be in danger of not doing it. You will be in danger of jettisoning what you say is of most importance to you for what really is of most importance to you. And that's what lies behind the scenario of the person you admired behaving in ways that seemingly totally contradict what they believed in. How did that happen? Well, some supreme value happened. Something that they valued more happened. Something that they valued more than their professed beliefs. Some idol of the heart happened. You see, it's not what we say we believe that determines how we live. It's what we love most. Okay, do the Sadducees do any better than the Pharisees? And the answer again is no. You see, they did not believe in the idea of resurrection, and they hear about Jesus raising a dead man. Do they reconsider their views? Do they reconsider their views on life and death? No, because ultimately, what they believe is not what matters most to them. Ultimately, the pursuit of truth and thinking rightly about God is not what they most love. And yet, if the Pharisees act contrary to their beliefs, the Sadducees, or at least Caiaphas, their spokesman, live true to theirs. Because as Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, says, it wasn't just that the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection, they also did not believe in any afterlife or final judgment or eternal rewards or punishment. For them, like we saw last week, carpe diem, seize the day, this life is it, and death is the end. Okay, what is one of the impacts of believing that, or of living true to that? Okay, well, look at what Caiaphas says, verses 49 to 50. You know nothing at all, which is Aramaic, for you are so stupid. Nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not the whole nation should perish. Okay, so Jesus is expendable. It is to our gain, Caiaphas is saying, if we throw him under the bus, or the first century equivalent of that, the donkey cart. To kill him is a price worth paying. But listen, if there is no final judgment, and life is about getting what you want, then what is to stop you behaving like that, if you can get away with it? Make power and position and maintaining those your ultimate, and you will use people. Or you would be willing to cast them aside when they are of no further use. Or make wealth and beauty your ultimate, and you will scorn the poor and the ugly. You'll cast them aside. Make comfort your thing, and you will want nothing to do with anyone who disturbs your comfort, who makes claims upon you. You'll be willing to cast them aside. Make anything other than God your God, and you will look down on the image bearers of God. Now you might say, yeah, I don't believe in a final judgment, but I don't live like that. And I would say, I believe you. But what you're doing is you're importing human dignity and the value of human beings into a system of belief that there's no foundation for. You're borrowing that from Christianity. And when it comes to Christ, if you make romance, boyfriend, girlfriend, career, freedom, whatever, your ultimate, and when push comes to shove, you will be in danger of casting Christ aside just like Caiaphas. But of course, what John makes clear is that Caiaphas is speaking better than he knows. Caiaphas says it's Jesus or us. Either he dies or we die. Guys, who's it going to be? And John says, verses 51 and 52, he did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation and not for the nation only. Okay, last point then. What should be of supreme value? What you should love above all things? You see, if you and I are not to live in fear of what other people think of us, or be at risk of compromising our beliefs, or of using people or seeing them as expendable, we need an ultimate in our lives that is not of this created order, that no one can threaten. Okay, we need God. We need the God. We need a supreme value who is the supreme value. We need a supreme power who is the supreme power. We need a supreme beauty who is beauty and love itself. Okay, so look again at what John says of Jesus. That Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. Can these leaders are worried about their position and their place. Was that Christ? Think about Christ, the ultimate leader. Because Jesus gave up the ultimate place. They are worried about their prestige. But Jesus gave up the ultimate glory. They are worried about their power. But Jesus humbled himself and emptied himself and gave up the ultimate place of power. And does he use you? No, he dies for you. Does he cast you aside? No, he is cast aside to gather you in. And here is Caiaphas, the high priest, saying we should sacrifice Jesus. And Jesus, the true high priest, comes and says to us, I will sacrifice myself for you. Because the consequences and the penalty of wrong values and wrong choices is death. But I will be your substitute. I will take your place. And I will gather all of you, Jew and Gentile, into the one new people of God. Guys, when your eyes are opened to his life laying down love for you, when you see how he leads, when you see how he gives himself, your love for him will grow and it will inevitably change you. Okay, love, position and prestige, and you'll put other people down. But be taken by Christ's sacrificial love for you, and you will give yourself, you will sacrifice yourself to see other people flourish. Think there is no final judgment, and you will have no moral basis for justice. But see Christ taking your punishment, and you will know that final judgment is real, and you will work for justice, but justice shot through with mercy, because Christ has been merciful to you. And in verses 55 and 56, John tells us that in the face of the leaders' threats, Jesus withdraws. But as he does, pilgrims start arriving. Now, the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and many went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. They were looking for Jesus. And of course, it was at the Passover feast that the Passover lamb was sacrificed. What is that? It's a remembrance of the first Passover and another substitute, when the lamb's life was given for the people's. And the pilgrims are coming to purify themselves before the feast. And the implication that John is making is that it's in Jesus, the one that they are looking for, that true purification can be found. I was recently speaking to a friend, and she told me that she recognizes that when she feels guilty for her failures to live up to her own standards, she looks for other people to blame. She's just being very honest. And she looks for a scapegoat. I mean, think how we all do that. Okay, we're angry with ourselves, some way that we failed, not met the mark, but we look for somebody else to blame. We look for somebody else to carry our sin. Okay, and think how in our cultural moment, blame shifting and victimhood lies beneath so many of our divisions. Okay, so more than ever, we need a better substitute. We need a better cleansing. Make your sense of personal worth your ultimate, and you will beat yourself up or take it out on others or both. But look to Christ taking your place. Look to him carrying your guilt. Look to him being your substitute and your sacrifice, and you will know a cleansing that sets you free. Free from the fear of others, free from the idols of the heart, and free to act justly and love mercy and walk humbly with your God. Make him your supreme value. Let's pray.